You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Folks, I don't get obsessed with a lot of television series, but one show that blew me away from day one and has kept me on the edge of my seat for going on 3 seasons now is HBO's Westworld. Besides boasting a spectacular cast that includes Anthony Hopkins, Ed Harris, Thandie Newton, Jeffrey Wright, and Evan Rachel Wood, Westworld is epic in scale and features some of the best writing on television. It also gives viewers a glimpse of the not-too-distant future, both the good and the bad, that doesn't seem so far from the realm of possibility. Indeed, much of the technology portrayed in Season 3, from self-driving cars to drone helicopters, is already in development right now. And there's yet another reason to love the new season of Westworld, the addition of Vincent Cassel to the cast. The French actor, who has been one of the best parts of films such as Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 13, Eastern Promises, Black Swan, and Jason Bourne, plays a reclusive billionaire who might hold the fate of the human race in his hands. And today, Vincent Cassel comes on the podcast to talk about joining the cast of one of his favorite TV series, his character's dark view of humanity, and how he attempts to make order out of the irrational. Vincent discusses how Westworld Season 3 deals with the very real problem of big data and who controls it, and says that it's even led him to be a lot more careful about what information he shares on his own devices. He also reminisces about the career of his father, famous French actor Jean-Pierre Cassel, and how Gene Kelly discovered his dad on the movie An American in Paris. Vincent recalls being heavily influenced by Hollywood films as a kid, learning to tap dance from Broadway legend Michael Bennett, and why he originally tried to join the circus before getting into acting. He reveals how he persuaded director Steven Soderbergh to let him do his own stunts in Ocean's 12, how an acting teacher inspired his role as the controlling choreographer in Black Swan, and why this Frenchman always seems to get cast as a Russian. Coming up with Vincent Cassel in just a moment. Actor Vincent Cassel has starred in many acclaimed movies in his native France, as well as Hollywood films like Ocean's 12, Ocean's 13, Eastern Promises, Black Swan, and Jason Bourne. Now he joins the Season 3 cast of HBO's phenomenal series Westworld as a reclusive tech mogul intent on controlling humanity at the same time as he tries to stop robots from destroying humanity. Vincent Cassel, welcome.
Hi, thanks for this wonderful introduction.
You're absolutely welcome. Now, due to the coronavirus and social distancing, we're actually doing this interview over the internet. Where are you right now, Vincent?
I am in France, in the southwest of France, nearby the French border. It's a place called Biarritz.
Oh, of course. It's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
Now, I understand that you kind of split your time between France and Brazil these days. Is that right?
Yeah, I've been doing this for like quite a while now.
What drew you to Brazil?
Movies. And especially movies, actually one movie and music, most of it.
Oh, really?
But that movie was called Black Orpheus.
Oh, right. Yeah, great movie. Fantastic film. Mm-hmm. Now, you actually come from a film family. Your father was a very famous French actor as well, Jean-Pierre Cassel. I didn't realize it until I was researching this interview, but I actually remember seeing your dad in the old Three Musketeers film.
Of course. He did Three Musketeers. He did one where he was playing Louis XIV, Louis XIV, and in another one, I think he played D'Artagnan when he was younger.
Yeah, and I remember, didn't they dub him in English in that film? Because it was sort of strange because all the other actors were English, but he was French and dubbed with an English accent.
I mean, they did some crazy stuff back in the past.
Yeah. Is it true that Gene Kelly actually discovered your dad and got him into the movies?
It's true, because my father was known to be a really good dancer in the clubs in the 50s in Saint-Germain-des-Prés. And he was looking for some people who could dance around in an American in Paris. So I think he was an extra on that one.
Oh, really? No kidding. An American in Paris. Wow. And you're also no slouch as a dancer as well. I understand that you're a classically trained ballet dancer. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't say that. But I trained for like years when I was younger, but not to be a dancer, really. Just to be practicing my body somehow.
Is it true that you also went to circus school before you decided to go into acting? What was that like?
Still practicing. Still practicing my body somehow. I was trying to figure out, you know, how to mix everything and eventually to introduce it into acting.
When you were a kid, did your dad ever encourage you to go into film?
Never, really.
Really?
No. He prevented me. He never tried to push me in any ways. He wanted me to finish my studies, and I think that's why I started with the circus. It's because it suddenly was a way to get into the limelight without being acting, so it wouldn't mm-hmm. scare him that much.
Mm-hmm. And growing up, what were the kind of films and actors who inspired you? Did you watch mostly French cinema or a lot of Hollywood films as well?
Well, when I grew up, I was somehow a bit anti-French Yes, in terms of movies, yes. I guess it was some kind of a rebellion of, you know, being a young upcoming actor. And I grew up mostly on American movies from the 70s, you know, Scorsese and Coppola and Sidney Lumet and all those guys.
Yeah.
And I would say on Italian cinema, everything that happened between, I would say, the 40s and the 70s in Italy, for me, is like the epitome of movie making.
Were there any actors from that era that you wanted to emulate with your career?
Emulate, I wouldn't say that, but I can tell you that when Marcello Mastroianni died, it was a very, very sad day.
Yeah, for me too. Well, I remember seeing one of your early films, La Haine, at an art house cinema here in L.A. And I'll tell you, to this day, I still think that that's one of your best performances. And as far as I know, wasn't that pretty much one of your first? It was your first big film break, right?
Yeah, film break, definitely. But I was 28 at the time already, and I started in the business when I was like 17. So I was already somehow a seasoned actor. I mean, you know, doing a little stuff, theater, all this kind of anything that I could, you know, any gig I could get, I would do it at the time. And then La Haine arrived and really changed the game for me.
And I read that you actually drew on a lot of your relationships with French hip-hop artists when you were preparing for that role. In fact, isn't your brother a pretty well-known rapper over there in France?
Well, you have to realize that in 95 was really like the blossoming of French hip hop. And I would say hip hop in general around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And my generation, so the people who were born around 66 and 75, we were in the middle of that, you know.
Yeah.
Everything was about Spike Lee and Run DMC and Public Enemy and, you know.
Really? Even in France?
That. Yeah.
That's funny. I didn't know that rap and hip hop were big in France, but my musical references
it's
are
huge.
So old. I kind of assume that everyone in France still listens to Edith Piaf and Yves Montand.
No. Rappers can be inspired by them.
Yeah.
But there's a very, very strong French hip hop scene still today.
Yeah. And French filmgoers also knew you for your role as the infamous French bank robber Jacques Mesrine in, I think, two back-to-back films. Is it true that you put on 40 pounds for that role? And how the hell did you do it? Because you're a pretty physically fit guy.
Well, it's something that I did once. I guess, you know, it was my Raging Bull fantasy.
Right.
You know, and I did it, and I was really proud of it. But I wouldn't do it anymore because, you know, this is very bad for you.
I can imagine. How do you put on that much weight?
Well, you eat too much. And to be honest, I had to be helped with a bit of medicine because I couldn't stop. You know, it's
really?
All about the insulin. So at the minute you change really that hormone, your body reacts totally differently to food and to fat and all that.
Yeah.
But that's why it's really not good for you.
And I read that French audiences also know you as the French voiceover of Hugh Grant in most of his films.
No, actually, I did two. I did two of them.
Oh, really?
I did Four Wedding and a Funeral, and that was a really good movie, actually. I really enjoyed doing it at the time.
Yeah.
Because as I told you, as a young actor, I would do any kind of gig, and dubbing was really good. And so I did that for quite. I still do the voice of Diego in the Ice Age.
Right, right.
I did a lot of cartoons and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Another string on the bow.
Yeah. What's the secret to doing a good Hugh Grant impression in French? Do you have to stutter a lot or what?
Well, in that movie in particular, he had to stutter a lot. But the funny thing is that if one day you see the French version of it and you have 5 minutes to listen, I had a cold that day.
Really?
So my Hugh Grant is a little sick.
Sounds kind of nasal, huh?
Totally.
Well, many Americans were first introduced to you as the art thief in Ocean's 12 and then Ocean's 13. What was it like to work with the modern-day Rat Pack, George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, Don Cheadle, and everyone else? I understand that they're very fun guys to be on set with.
Fun and very, I was a little worried, to be honest. You know, I mean, all those people at once was a little too much for me to handle, I would say. But George Clooney, as we know, is a very warm and delicate person. So the way he welcomed me in the middle of that you know band of people was very very was very easy for me to let go my ideas and to be part of the whole process. I mean, it was more a pleasure than anything else.
Yeah, and I think Ocean's 12 was probably my favorite in that whole series just because everything about it just exuded cool and the settings were so fantastic and you were so terrific. I have to say, you had a little bit of Cary Grant in you, I thought.
I like it.
And there's that cool scene in Ocean's 12 where you're working your way through a laser field in a museum. I know that you're very skilled at various martial arts. Did you do your own stunts in that scene?
Yes, the thing is, when I received the script at the time, I remember I was in Brazil once again, and I've seen the scene, and I thought, well, I've seen that before. You know, we've seen a entrapment and stuff like that. So I called Steven Soderbergh at the time and said, "Have you heard about capoeira?" And he said, "No, I don't know what it is." And we were supposed to meet like a few days later in Rome. And so in that hotel room, I started to show him the moves and I gave him some videos and he said, "Oh yeah, I love it. So why not?" You know? And so we introduced, and that was a little bit of, it was a bit of a, you know, it was a shout out to Brazil to put this Brazilian martial art in a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, I was amazed by that scene. I could not bend in those positions personally. I'm not physically capable.
I That's can't anymore, amazing. I tell you that.
Well, another great film you did here in the U.S. was Black Swan, where you played the director of the ballet. I wondered at the time if you had based that character on George Balanchine. Did you?
Well, him and a bunch of other people, to be honest, because I never had the chance to approach Balanchine, but I heard about him. I've seen documentaries and hear people talking about him. But then I realized that it's something that I've seen before. And especially when I was really younger, I had the opportunity to be really, really close to an American director from Broadway called Michael Bennett.
Oh, yeah,
of course. I don't know if you heard about him.
Yeah, he's a legend.
Chorus Line, Dreamgirls, Ballroom, all that. All this
Yeah.
And I remember there was something like that about Michael, in the sense that those guys are very tough, very hard, very demanding. But in the same time, they're so dedicated to what they do, because this is the only way they exist, that somehow it forgives them a bit for their toughness. So instead of portraying a predator, I would say I was trying to portray an uncompromising artist.
What was the project that you worked with Michael Bennett on? Was that a Broadway project? Or
no,
what?
I never worked with him.
Oh,
it's a family story, really. My mother at the time used to live with him.
Oh, okay.
She, So she, I was, you know, I've been a part of a lot of the process.
Yeah.
He actually directed a little dance number that I would do in the street when I was 16.
Really? No kidding. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, a tap dance number.
So you tap dance as well, huh?
I tap dance for a while, yeah.
Do a little bit of everything.
Exactly. That's the idea.
And your mom was a journalist, is that right?
She was a journalist, yeah, and in New York. That's why I had this close relationship with New York somehow. And I hanged out a lot in New York in the 80s, going to classes over there too, and, you know.
You are a man of many talents. You also speak a number of languages. How many languages do you speak these days?
I would say five.
Five.
But three of them are Latin languages, so it's not that hard when you think about it.
Right. But I also understand that you picked up conversational Russian when you were doing Eastern Promises. That's a lot harder than Latin languages.
Yeah, because let's say the English speaking industry had a tendency at the time to cast me as a Russian. I don't know why. I had the opportunity to work with Steven Soderbergh for that reason, so I wouldn't complain.
Yeah.
I did another movie back in the days with Jace Butterworth and Nicole Kidman called Birthday Girl. I was a Russian there too.
Yeah.
So, you know, movie after movie, you learn how to do a lot of stuff, really. Speak languages, horseback riding, to fight with a sword. You learn about guns, about, you know, kung fu, whatever. You know, you learn about a lot of different stuff.
Yeah. I read in your bio that you said that you wanted to learn every skill that there is to prepare you for acting. And that's almost an old Hollywood studio mentality from Hollywood's golden age, where everyone who went into the studio system had to learn fencing and dancing and singing.
Exactly.
And
but
everything.
You know what? That's,
yeah.
That's because of my father. I
really?
Think because my father was such a fan of Fred Astaire and all that era.
Mm, yeah.
That I think that somehow the idea that he implied in everything he told me. And so, yes, I really had the feeling that for more than 10 years, I studied everything I could, you know, from acting to singing to dancing to fighting, to be able to pretend that I could do anything.
Yeah, and it seems like you really can do anything.
Not really.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. Right now, companies, governments, and pretty much any organization are being stalked by cybercriminals. And at some point, when the time is right, they will be successfully attacked by malicious actors seeking money, retribution, or political gain. Afternoon Cyber Tea with Ann Johnson provides insights for CISOs and key security decision makers who want to empower themselves with the information to ward off cyber attacks and the disruption they cause. Each week, Ann Johnson, Corporate Vice President for Cybersecurity Solutions at Microsoft, talks with the nation's top cybersecurity thought leaders and influential experts about what they're seeing and doing. She and her guests cover topics like election and national security, diversity in the cyber industry, and how a culture of information sharing is one of the best defenses. Join Ann to explore the risk and promise of tools and systems powered by AI, IoT, machine learning, and other emerging technology, and get ideas for strategies that can head off intrusions from malware to man in the middle. Afternoon Cyber Tea is available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Podcast One. Subscribe now. I mentioned at the top that you recently joined the cast of HBO's Westworld in Season 3. I am already a huge fan of that show, and even more so in season three. And what a fantastic time for you to come into that series, just as we're finally getting to see the world of the future outside of the Westworld theme park.
Totally, yeah. But I didn't know about that when they called me, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They presented me the character in a way that, you know, they tell you a lot, but they don't tell you much in the same time, because I guess sometimes they didn't know yet. You know, it's an ever evolving kind of process of writing and creation with Lisa Joy and Jonah. And so it's a different way to work. I really enjoyed it, you know, but you don't control much. So you have to focus on what you have.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I guess as an actor, sometimes if you've read the whole season, it's hard for you to not play that role with the end game in mind. So I guess it probably helps if they kind of slowly give you bits of information as you film, huh?
Yes, and plus, you know, some stuff are obvious when you see them on screen, you know, with the right sound and everything. But on paper, when, you know, you've been talking to somebody for like two scenes and suddenly that person disappears because she wasn't really there.
Right.
And it's full of stuff here, and, you know, it's full of tricks like this in the narrative. So
yeah,
it's easier to get it when you watch it than when you read it.
Yeah.
So at a certain point, when you don't know everything and what you have is not really super understandable, I'd rather focus on what I have to say and, you know, to work on the character more than the story.
Yeah, that's smart. I have to say, as a viewer, I am constantly surprised by that show. I don't think there's a single episode where that show isn't way smarter than me. But especially last season, how the story jumped around in time a lot.
Yes.
Now, I'm curious, does season three mostly follow a linear timeline?
Yes, a little more. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'll discover. Which episode have you seen yet?
I've seen the first four.
You did. Oh, you've seen more than me.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yes. I've seen only one, actually, to be honest.
As we're taping this, I think that there have been two full episodes that have aired at this point. So I'm a little bit ahead of everyone here.
Yeah.
Did you watch the first two seasons, and were you a fan of the series already?
Yeah, totally. These are one of the few series that I've been following from A to Z.
And in the show, you play a mysterious tech mogul, and I hope I pronounced this right, named Enguerrand Serac. What can you tell us about him?
He is very rich, very powerful, very smart and educated. He has very good intentions, except that he's ready to impose those intentions to the rest of the world without asking.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So he managed to have the luxury of knowing everything about everybody, and nobody knows a single thing about him. In the modern days, it's almost impossible, actually.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's interesting because a lot of fans and critics have really praised you in this new season. And when they do so, they're referring to Serac as the villain of this season. But I've found with Westworld, it's very hard to tell the good guys from the bad guys. And sometimes the good guys become the bad guys or vice versa.
Yeah. It's all a question of perspective.
Yeah. I wonder if you think it's a too simplistic a read on your character to just call him a villain this season.
Well, you know, it's a big show and we know what people are waiting for somehow. But I've been specialized in villains that you can understand and you can root for. That's the idea.
Right, right.
So if he's a villain, if at least we can understand of, you know, why he's doing what he does, you know, that's already a lot.
I suppose it all depends on whose perspective you're looking from. He's trying to stop Dolores from destroying the human race. I think those episodes have already aired, so I'm not giving anything away. But then if you're Dolores or the other host, you probably do see him as a villain. So it all depends on whose perspective you're looking at it from.
That's one of the really great things about the show is that they make you root for machines.
Mm-hmm.
And that old perspective is totally messed up with the first two seasons. The fact that we shoot and slaughter people, you know, but they're not people.
Right.
But we still react to the image of it. So it puts you in a position where it's very hard to judge. It really blends your own limits, I guess.
And your character, Serac, also has a pretty dark opinion of the human race himself. How would you describe his worldview?
Well, you know, he's a politic somehow. He knows that if you ask everybody what they want, he's not going to get to the point. So the idea is controlling the mass without them knowing. And that's the world we live in, really.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, you know, in some ways, your character is doing something entirely reasonable and logical. I mean, he controls this form of super artificial intelligence that actually makes human behavior less irrational and almost entirely predictable. Some might say that might be a good thing.
Who has the key to the computer?
Right, exactly. Can you explain the system, I think I have this right, Rehoboam?
Rehoboam.
Rehoboam. Now, how does that predict and control human behavior on the show?
Well, I don't think I should tell you too much because the way it works, it will be told and very precisely in the next episode.
Okay.
But imagine a processor that can process all the data of everybody in the whole world.
Wow.
What do you do with this?
Yeah, that's a lot of power in one person's hands or one machine's hands or whatever. Has the plot of Westworld made you more paranoid about, say, giving websites permission to access your data or what kind of things your smartphone might be recording about you?
You know, I've seen the documentaries about Snowden, about all those whistleblowers, Assange and everybody, and I can see how they treat their the IP terminals.
Mm-hmm.
They do put a little bit of tape on the thing. They do take the cord off the wall when it's needed and stuff like that. So, yes, of course, I'm sure we. But there is so much information. You know, how do they process that? Do they already have a Rehoboam?
Who knows? Gosh. Yeah, and it's so
exactly.
easy to give that information away. I think most of us, a lot of times, we just click a button to, you know, give a website access to our cookies and that kind of thing, and we don't even think mm-hmm. twice about it.
What I try to think sometimes when I'm too worried about that is that the bottom line is that we all want to hide, but we all live the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same problems, the same vices, it's the same, you know, little dark stuff. On very rare occasions, do extraordinary things. Most of the times, you know, everybody does the same shit at home.
True. That's true. Who knows? Someone may be listening to us right now as we're talking. In fact,
well, hopefully.
It's pretty likely. Yeah. Well, hopefully when this airs, someone will listen at least.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. I also get a real sense of isolation in season 3 of Westworld. There seem to be fewer and fewer real-world human interactions in the future. Everyone exists in their own world in self-driving cars, autonomous helicopters, artificial intelligence, and they seem starved for connection. And I think it really speaks to this moment that we're in right now with social distancing and the coronavirus. Do you worry that we might now be on an accelerated path to that lonely future that gets depicted in season 3?
In the cities, where, yes. I guess after what we're going through right now, there will be a boom of people like hugging and kissing and wanting to go out and to enjoy the togetherness,
yeah.
at least for a while, like after the World Cup.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. And I don't want to give away too much here, but I have to say, your beloved hometown of Paris does not fare well in the future either. So,
I don't want to know.
Yeah. Well, season 3 of Westworld airs Sundays on HBO. Vincent Cassell, it was such a pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Very nice talking to you. And take care of yourself and stay home.
You too. All right. Thanks, Vincent.
Ciao.
Thanks again to Vincent Cassell for coming on the show. Season 3 of Westworld airs Sundays on HBO. For more information, visit hbo.com. Times are tight right now. So what would you do if your computer broke and wasn't covered by warranty, or you suddenly needed electrical work on your house? Do you have enough saved up to take care of sudden emergency expenses like those? American Home Shield, America's most preferred home warranty, gives you a plan when stuff breaks down in your home, stuff insurance doesn't cover, and stuff you don't want to mess with or go broke trying to get fixed. Go to ahs.com/kick today to save $50 and start protecting your home and budget from inevitable breakdowns. That's ahs.com/kick for $50 off any plan. American Home Shield. Be sure with Shield. Limitations and exclusions apply. See plan for details. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com. And I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.